Please help me welcome our speaker, Chris from Lancaster.
Brown suit, where you at? There you are. I got this light here right in my eye. I know you didn't have that problem last week because you're not here. But. Hey. My name's Christopher Dreisbach. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
I'm going to make you laugh at least once tonight. It's my goal. You all right with that? Cool. So, that's really all I got. Didn't work. It did. I got one. All right. Cool. Well, I'll start out real briefly. Can you guys hear me if I stay away from this microphone? It's not a very big room.
Stay with the microphone.
I can't. It'll help you?
Yes. How will this help you? I will yell into this for you. I promise that every time I need to say something, I will lean down awkwardly like this, stare directly at you, and talk. It's more fun to do it awkwardly, though. Because even this is awkward. Everything about a microphone is awkward. Just saying.
So, I was told a long time ago that in order to stand up in front of a group of people and bore them for 50-some minutes, I first had to qualify myself to do so. The ways I was told that I had to qualify myself were I had to have some things going on in my life in order to stand up here in front of this bright light in my face and talk. And the first of those is I had to have a sobriety date, which I have. I have a sobriety date that's August 27th of 2007. I have a home group. That's another thing I had to have. It's the Mountville Speakers Group. Meeting right now at this very moment in the booming metropolis of Mountville, Pennsylvania. You gonna throw that at me? All right. It's a meeting real similar to this one, It's a 1-hour speaker meeting, and it's pretty cool because we get people that come in from all over the place, and they carry a message of hope, hopefully. I think Rich might come down soon, so that might end that streak. But, you know. I had to. I had to shoot at him a little bit. He wasn't even listening. It's okay. Ooh. It wasn't my first home group in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had another home group prior to that when I was new. And at that home group, I got a guy called a sponsor. Is anybody here familiar with that concept? Anybody?
I heard of it.
Okay. They have that in Quakertown? Okay. Just checking. I haven't been here for a few years. Last time I was here, it was outside in that pavilion, right? And it was real nice. There were dogs outside barking and it was just a lovely time. So, and I think before that, I was here in like 2008 with my sponsor, actually, who I was just talking about. And it was in like the church part of the church, maybe. I don't know. That was a really long time ago. And my brain doesn't work. But that sponsor that I obtained, he took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Can you hear me? Okay. And as a result of having been taken through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had this really strange thing called a spiritual awakening. And as a result of that spiritual awakening, my entire life flipped upside down in an awesome way. And I now have the honor and the privilege of taking other people through the 12 steps and watching them have that same exact spiritual experience, that spiritual awakening that is guaranteed as a result of the work. And so those things combined apparently qualify me to come to Quakertown, Pennsylvania and talk to you. I don't know if that's true. I don't really care if that's true, but here we are. Here we are. So, yeah. You guys awake? Who's sleeping? Who's about to fall asleep? Little Hawk? Brown suit? You good? I like to start out with a slightly offensive story. For those of you who've heard this slightly offensive story, you may take a nap now. For those of you who haven't, here it is. You know, I'm from this place not too far from here called Emmaus, Pennsylvania. Is anybody here familiar with Emmaus? That's why I love coming here, because you guys know where I'm from. It's awesome. I go to places like Connecticut, they're like, what the hell are you talking about? What is an Emmaus? You know, and So I was down in this place called The Last Stop in Philadelphia. Anybody ever been there? Anybody ever heard of that? For those of you who are unfamiliar, it's a very scary place. It's like the worst spot in a bad city of Philadelphia. You know, it's like right in the heart of the worst section. And they asked me to go down and speak probably like 6 or 7 years ago when I was fairly new. And I had never been to this section of Philadelphia that everybody had, you know, glorified as a terrifying place. So I was naturally full of fear. I was very scared that when I went to this place, this last stop in Kensington in Philadelphia, that I was going to get robbed or mugged or murdered or raped or who knows what was going to happen, you know? And I went down, and I'll paint you a little picture of this room. It was a tiny, tiny little room, and it was the middle of winter, so every homeless guy in Philadelphia was in there because it was warm. And I'm about to get up and speak, and the guy that's like right in front of me is like literally right in front of me. Like I could probably have kissed him standing up. It was very scary. And I mentioned that I was from Emmaus, Pennsylvania, and I asked if anybody was familiar. And at that exact moment, he jumped up from his seat and he went, "I smoke crack in Emmaus!" Yeah. Yeah. And I was scared because it was the last stop. That's the last place you want to go. And I was scared because I was there and he was 3 inches in front of me and he jumped up and it was awful and terrifying. So if you were asleep before that story, please wake up now. Are you awake? You? All right. What's your name?
Tamara.
Tamara. Okay. Brown suit, you're off the hook tonight. So, like I said, I was born in this place called Emmaus, Pennsylvania. Had some really cool stuff happening for me in Emmaus. I had a mom and a dad who are still together to this day. Had a couple of dogs running around, a bunch of little brothers. We had a house that had 4 walls and a roof. You know, I had plenty of clothing to wear and plenty of food to eat, as you could still clearly see. You know, if we were looking in from the outside, you would say that I had literally every single thing I would have needed to make something happen in the world. You know, theoretically speaking, you would have looked in and said, "Chris, you could go be a lawyer, you know, if you weren't so dumb. You could go be an astronaut if you weren't so big and awkward looking. You know, you could do whatever you want." I had everything externally set up in place for me to make an impact on the world. You know, from the second I can remember anything, I had this real awkward, awful feeling inside. And on my best day back then, I could never, ever, ever place to words what was wrong with me internally. Never could I place those words. But now, many years later, I can at least explain to you some of the symptoms I experienced when I was younger. And one of them I like to talk about is when I was in a social situation. Like, for example, if I'm in a room with a whole bunch of people I don't know. Tamara, I know you now, so we're cool. But I was absolutely full of fear. I was absolutely horrified to be in a room with a bunch of people I didn't know. And I just wanted to kind of sit back in the dark corner with the birdhouse back there or whatever that is and just hide from everybody because it was scary. I felt extremely disconnected from every other human being in the room with me. Even worse than that, if I was in a room with a bunch of people I did know, I still felt that same awkward just disconnect from life. Even worse than that, if I was in a room with my family, people who love me more than anything in the universe, I still had that same feeling, that awkward, awful, like I just don't mesh very well. And even worse than that, if I was in a room completely alone with just me and the awesome, you know, blue chairs here, I still felt that same way. Like there just was something very wrong and something not right. You relate to that? Dig it. Non-committal. That's good. That's the way to be. Another thing I like to talk about is for some strange reason, when I was younger, I could never sleep at night. Has anybody in here ever experienced difficulty sleeping in the evening? How about without like trazodone and things like that? Yeah, a couple more hands. I dig that. And so the reason I could never sleep at night was because for some strange reason, I was always thinking about everything under the sun. My mind was racing a billion miles a second, and I'd literally be 6 years old sitting stressing how I'm going to pay for my homeowner's insurance one day. And it's just out of control. My mind never stops, and I never sleep. And what really sucks about that is when I was young up in Emmaus, I don't know if you're familiar, but they have to go to this thing called school. Anybody ever been to school? Yeah, about 4 of you, believe it. Sorry. Where I'm from, this really ugly thing called school starts real early in the morning, And when I don't sleep very well at night because I'm sitting up stressing everything under the sun, I don't do very well in the mornings. So I go to school and I'm already tired and it already sucks and I already hate it. And I get there and it's this awkward, awful social situation. I'm trapped in a room with 20 people all day long. And there's a teacher I'm supposed to pay attention to her. She's scribbling stuff on chalkboards, you know, and I'm super concerned about what everybody's thinking about me at all times. What are you thinking about me, man? Like you want to hit me in the parking lot? That's the second laugh. I'm good. I'm good to go now. I got him to laugh. So I don't do very well in school because this is one simple fact that I can't pay attention to anything and I'm super uncomfortable and it's absolutely awful. So I pushed through to the best of my ability for like 13 years or so, however long that is, you know. And this one magical day when I'm 13 years old, I get to go to a thing called a wedding. Anybody ever been to one of those before? Familiar? Seen that? One person in here has been to a wedding? I'll just talk to you. Two. A man. So, fellas, I'm at this wedding, and I'll paint you a little picture of what this wedding looked like for those of you who've never been to one. Is that a fire hall? You guys have seen fire halls. We have them around here. Basically the cheapest place you can rent to gather humans. And at the front of this fire hall, there was a nice table laid out, right? A nice table. And it had a bunch of plastic jugs in it on it. And they were filled with this liquid, probably cheap watered down liquor, you know, mixed with other things to like make it even cheaper. And I was sitting in the back corner, you know, by the birdhouse, wishing I was dead and not there or anywhere but there. And I was observing all the adults laughing and dancing, having a good time going up to that open bar and drinking and enjoying themselves. And I was doing none of those things back in the corner, kind of wishing I was anywhere but there. So after a little bit of that misery, I discovered this magical idea that, like, you know, maybe if I went up to that open bar and drank, I'd probably have a better time too. You know, being 13 years old, the incredible ability to be larger than everybody else and grow facial hair very rapidly, I walked up to that bar and nobody said one word. And I took a little plastic cup and I put it up under the plastic jug and I filled the cup and I drank. And I repeated that process and I repeated that process again, I repeated that process again. And over the course of repeating that process, the single greatest thing in all 13 years of my life had occurred. Is suddenly I realized that my mind wasn't racing anymore. And suddenly I felt awfully comfortable in that social situation I was uncomfortable in just moments before. And I started to laugh. And I started to dance. I started to have a good old time. It was magical. Yeah, you're right. Right? It really was. What's that? No, no, it was my family, dude. Yeah, it's a little scary. That's a good question, though. Good question. Are you a reporter? You got notes over here? Okay. Okay. I'm just checking. And so what happened was I was enjoying myself quite a bit, drinking and dancing and having a good old time, you know. You just tossed me right off my game, dude. Until the end of the night when I got grounded for the rest of my life, you know, because when you're 13 years old, you're not allowed to do what I did that night. And I went back home to my room where I'd never been comfortable in my entire life ever before, and grounded for the rest of my life, which is a real grim prospect for a 13-year-old. And I went right into my bedroom, and I hit my head on a pillow, and went right to sleep, first time ever. Didn't sit up, didn't, you know, stress about what the Clinton administration was doing. I went right to bed. I did nothing, you know, it was perfect. I think George Bush was probably the president. I don't even know. But I was still stressing Clinton at that point, I'm sure. But thanks to that magical liquid, I went right to sleep, and it was beautiful. I woke up the next morning, and I understood what had occurred the night before. And the only thing that was on my mind that I could recall was, how can I obtain some more of that stuff? How can I find someone who's 21 or older to get me some more of that? Because that was beautiful. I understood that with that stuff, my life looked way better, and without it, my life looked real terrible. And so I thankfully had an uncle who was over 21, and he went out and he obtained for me a squeeze bottle fifth of Governor's Club whiskey, only the classiest drink for a classy guy like me. You know, $5.99, real classy. And he hand-delivered it to me in my bedroom, thankfully. And when I was sitting in there, uncomfortable because I'm grounded for the rest of my life, real awkward. Hey, Joe. You know, super awkward, awful, grounded forever. It really sucks. He brought me that bottle of whiskey, and I untwisted the cap, and I drank. And I repeated that process and repeated that process again. The same thing that happened the night before happened again. Just like clockwork. And so, long story super short, I made it my absolute goal from that second on to obtain alcohol as often as I possibly could. Because it made me feel a whole lot better. And that was the only important thing to me. And it went on like that for a period of time. And after a while, everybody turned and stared. Only like 3 people turned and stared. You guys are not listening very well. I'm going to go on strike up here. Sorry. I get bored sometimes up here. You know, I got to keep it interesting. And I can't help it when a spiritual behemoth like that walks through the door. Now I'm terrified. It's true. Where was I, little hawk? I don't know. You weren't paying attention either.
Oh, no. There's 8 o'clock in your bedroom. Huh? I don't know where I was anymore.
I gotta find my water.
All better tomorrow. We're all good now. Okay.
Yeah. All right. So, Jamie threw me way off. So, it worked like that for a period of time. And after a while, I'd find myself drinking large amounts of alcohol, large enough amounts to kill small people. Jim, I miss you so much, man, by the way. Just saying. Yeah, I found myself drinking a whole lot, a whole massive amount. And for some strange reason, no matter how much I drank, and no matter how much I piled into my body, my mind would still race. And no matter how much I drank, and no matter how much I piled into my body, I would still have that uncomfortable disconnect going on inside. And thankfully, you know, I got introduced to some other things. And for those of you who are super AA purists, I'll apologize way in advance. But I got introduced to this thing called marijuana. And if you've never heard of it, I don't know if they have it in Quakertown. Probably not, right? No? No, I know you've never seen it, man. And what happens, the important piece here, is when I consume this marijuana, is what that does for me. And it takes my mind and it stops it from racing. And it takes that awful disconnect inside of me and it closes it right up. Makes me feel comfortable. It also makes my eyes really red and makes me eat a lot of Doritos. And I like things like that. You know, I'm a large man. I like Doritos. I can't help it. And so, it works like that for a period of time. And after a while, I find myself consuming that stuff, doing all sorts of crazy things with it, like baking it into pastries, you know, and mixing it into tea, and I'm drinking alcohol in conjunction with it, and no matter what I'm doing, I'm still uncomfortable, and no matter what I'm doing, I still can't get to that place I want to get, and no matter what I'm doing, my mind is still racing, and no matter what's going on, I'm just not okay, and I get introduced to a bunch of other interesting things, like some psychedelics and some pharmaceuticals, and in their own unique and individual ways, they make me feel comfortable. They produce an effect that I was shooting for from that second I was at that wedding when I was 13. And after a period of time, they stopped working the way they once did too. And I get introduced to another strange white powdery thing called cocaine. I don't know if anybody here has seen it. They probably don't have it out this far, you know, in the middle of a swamp or wherever we are. Yeah? You guys have seen it on TV? Okay. Respect it. Well, when I consume that stuff, it might shock you what effect it produces. Is it makes me feel real comfortable inside. It takes my mind and makes it race in a really good way. It makes me run around like a maniac, chuck the Doritos out the window. It's great. For a period of time. And after a while, all this stuff does is make me paranoid. And all this stuff, it doesn't produce the effect that it once did. You know, and I run into this little dilemma, you know, like I'm disappearing for 3 or 4 days at a time. I have like 38 bottles of NyQuil shoved under my passenger seat. It's just not producing the effect that it used to. And I have this serious dilemma where I know there's only one place left to go, and I'm absolutely unwilling to go there. You know, that other place, I've seen other people do this stuff, and I've seen people die, and I've seen it destroy their lives, and I'm absolutely unwilling to go any further. So I take a, you know, stick, and I draw a proverbial treatment center line in the sand, And I say, I will never, ever, 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 ever do anything worse than I've already done to this point. And I make a very firm resolution in my mind not to do so. Very firm resolution. And the strangest thing in the world happens. Is I go to a keg party. You ever been to one of those? They have kegs here?
No.
Yeah, no. Shut up, Brown Steve. And at this keg party, I'm standing right by the keg because that's like where I post up at parties like that. It's where I'm commonly located, you know. And a guy approached me with a little wax paper bag, and it was filled with a brown powdery substance I swore I would never, ever in my entire life touch, ever. And he said to me something like this, Chris, would you like to try this? And I immediately responded with yes. For some strange reason, I lacked the ability to stop, take a peek at what the consequences could be. You know, maybe like make a good pros and cons list of trying this stuff. I lacked the ability to do those things. I lacked the ability to make a phone call to a trusted advisor. You know, hey, this guy's approaching me with stuff. What do I do? You know, but from that, I said yes immediately. And what happened was I consumed this stuff in that wax paper bag. And the effect that it produced was amazing. It took my mind and it rendered it completely incapable of processing a thought. Completely incapable. And it took that awful, awkward feeling inside of me and it crushed it. Right? And that was the effect that I was looking for my entire life. All of my 18 years to that point. All in my glorious wisdom, you know? And what happened was a whole lot of not that good stuff. At that point, the keg party, I had a whole lot of really good stuff going on in my life. I'll paint you a little picture of my external world. My external world looked really good. I had a prestigious career. I was waiting tables at Friendly's, you know, in Trexler Town. That's prestigious, you know. I had a bank account. It had money in it. That's important. Right? I had a 1991 Oldsmobile, Regency Elite 98, really nice car. It was legal. It was registered. It was insured, inspected. I had a driver's license. Everything was perfect. Right? I had a girlfriend. I also had a really cool side career selling things that weren't available in traditional retail markets, you know. And if you're looking at my life from that point, I was feeling really good about it. I had everything I wanted. Everything. Except for I felt awful inside all the time. And then I found that stuff in that wax paper bag at that keg party. And within 30 days, my entire world had shifted. And I can paint you a picture of what it looked like 30 days after the keg party. Is the prestigious career that I had waiting tables at Friendly's was gone. Because they hate it when you show up, throw up in a trash can, take a four-hour lunch break, and come back like nothing ever happened. Every day. They asked me to leave, you know. The bank account I had that had money in it was gone even quicker than that. You know, the 1991 Oldsmobile, Regency Elite 98, beautiful car, was crashed. It was also doubling as my home within 30 days. And the really cool side career that I had going on was gone as well because of the simple business principle, people hate paying for things they don't receive. And within 30 days, yeah, take notes. Okay. And within 30 days, my entire world had shifted. Externally, everything had crashed in 30 days. But internally, everything was wonderful because as long as I had something to make me feel okay inside, it didn't matter what occurred outside. But then I run into another dilemma. I don't know if anybody's ever run into a dilemma similar to this. But I can't seem to wait tables for more than $10 at a time. Because when I obtain a $10 bill, I disappear. Very rapidly. You ever see somebody this side disappear rapidly? No. It's weird. It's awkward. But if it was 2004 or 2005, again, you gave me a $10 bill, I would have shown you very quickly. And so, when I can't maintain a job, when I can't do anything like that, and I need money to keep feeling okay, I have to resort to some things that some only real tough guys do, and you strike me as a real tough guy. That was the best reaction ever. I'll leave you alone now, man. Well, for this tough guy, I had to do the only thing a real tough guy like me can do, which is I had to start taking things from my mommy, you know? And when my mom went and grabbed a DVD and stick it in the DVD player, and neither of those existed, she got naturally upset, you know? And she hit me with an ultimatum. And she said, listen, Chris, you either need to go to detox or you just need to get away from me, right? And at that point, homelessness was not on my agenda. I was not interested in being homeless at that point. It wasn't on my little black book, you know? It was nowhere in there, Tamara. It was not. And so I agreed to go to this detox. And the lovely county of Lehigh graciously provided me a bed at an old, you know, state hospital right down the street from the Karen Foundation. And, you know, I went. And I went to that place and I was peeing my pants. I was so scared going into this place because I was about to separate myself from the only thing in the world that made me feel okay. And it was awful. I got into this hospital-style detox and there were six guys that spoke zero English and me. And when I stopped taking the thing that I was taking, I feel physically awful. And when I stopped taking the thing that I was taking, I feel even worse inside. And I didn't last very long, but I made it about 10 days. 10 days, I pushed through the detox process. That's right. And I got into the rehab portion. And I accumulated some awesome ideas as to how I was going to keep myself sober when I left. And I'll share with you those ideas because I think they're very good. You should be taking notes again. Right here. This is okay. Because when I get out of this really awesome hospital-style detox, what I'm going to do is I'm going to obtain a job. I'm going to work a lot of hours. I'm going to get back with my girlfriend and everything is going to work out perfectly. Because now I've been separated from everything for several days, which is an absolute record for a guy like me. So you are taking notes. I knew it. And what happened is I grabbed my bag and I hucked it over my shoulder and I hitchhiked down Route 422 and I called everybody I knew a couple of times until somebody finally came and picked me up. You know, my parents took some pity on me and brought me back to their house. And the next morning, I sat down at the kitchen table with my dad, my awesome, awesome, naturally principled dad who has no idea what he's up against. And I had no idea what I was up against. And he said, "What's your plan, you idiot? What are you going to do?" I said, "Man, I'm going to get a job. I'm going to work a lot of hours. I'll get back with my girlfriend. Everything is going to work perfectly because I've been clean now for a few days. You know, I can properly exercise the use of my will. Everything's going to work out, right?" Jeff. And you know what? Keys in my hand. I left his house. Mayus, Pennsylvania. Every intention of obtaining employment. Every intention getting back with my girlfriend, but within a couple of hours, I found myself asleep in a bathroom, highly intoxicated. And it didn't make much sense to me how that occurred, because I had just left there with every intention to do the complete opposite, but it happened anyway, and I felt a whole lot better than I had in the previous 10 days, so I didn't really look into it too deeply. But I ran into the same dilemmas. I didn't really have any money. I couldn't wait tables for more than $10 at a time. My mom had the DVDs locked up and guarded. You know, it sucks. So I had to go do the only thing a real tough guy like me can do, is I had to take other things from other people's houses. You know, within 30 days of leaving this awesome, awesome rehab, I found myself getting arrested on multiple felony burglary charges. Because, take notes on this one, in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, it's totally illegal to walk into other people's houses and take their stuff. But at that point, you could have fooled me. Because I thought I was just a hard-working guy trying to get through another day. I really legitimately, in my awesome alcoholic mind, thought that I was just a hard-working guy. I thought that your change jar was my desk, you know? I thought that your Indiana Jones DVD collection was like my, you know, computer. And that was what I was doing. Like, that was my occupation. And the police did not see it that way. They saw quite the opposite. And they took me to this place called Lehigh County Prison. And 30 days prior to this, I was peeing my pants going to detox because I was so scared. And now I'm going to jail, and all I know about jail, Jeff, is the stuff TV tells you. Is that Bubba's coming to get me, and it's going down, you know? And I'm really big. I'm really big, but I know Bubba's at least a foot taller and 100 pounds heavier. And he's just waiting to give me a shoulder massage, you know, and I'm not okay. And I go to this place. Yeah, right, you know, I was afraid I was holding on to the soap, yeah. And I go to jail, and there's no Bubba there, but I get to hang out for several months. And a long story real short is over the course of that several months, I accumulate some ideas as to how I'm going to keep myself sober when I get out, because that's the point of being there, right? To correct yourself and stuff. And I figure if as long as I get out of this place and get a job, work a lot of hours, get back with my girlfriend, everything's going to work perfectly, because now I've been sober for several months, and it makes perfect sense. Now I can properly exercise the use of my will. Now I'll be okay. And my dad picks me up and graciously takes me somewhere to harbor me. And he sits me down and he says, "Man, what are you going to do, you idiot?" And I say, "Pop, I'm going to get a job. I'm going to work a lot of hours. Get back with my girlfriend. I've been clean for 6 months. Everything's going to work perfectly this time." And he says, "Awesome idea. Go do it." And bam, keys back in my hand. And within a couple hours, I found myself asleep in a bathroom, highly intoxicated. Somewhere in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And it didn't make much sense. But I didn't really care because I felt a whole lot better than I did for the previous 6 months. But now I got this different thing. I got this guy called a PO. I don't know if anybody here has ever seen them before. Well, this one specifically wanted me to pee in cups. And when my hobby and my career is sleeping in a bathroom, I don't pee in the cup the way he wants me to. So, you know, he gives me an ultimatum. He says, you'll have 7 days to fix this problem. If you don't fix this problem, you're going to go to jail. And I say, okay, that makes sense. Mathematics start immediately in my head. It means I have 4 days to continue. I have to stop what I'm doing and I won't go to jail because I don't ever want to go back there again. It was very unpleasant, right? Makes good sense. Those 4 days slide by real effortlessly and the day comes that I have to stop. And I wake up in the morning and I don't feel too good inside at all. I figure it's cool because if I drink enough water, I could beat his test and I'll be fine. You know, I can still go about my business today. And I do that and I come home and I go to sleep and I wake up the next morning. I know I have 2 days to go see this PO. And I know that if I don't pee the way he wants me to, I'm going to go to jail. But I really don't want to go there. But I really don't feel too well. And I figure it's cool because if I eat some vitamins, I could beat his test and everything will be okay. Right? Makes good sense. So I go about my business and I come back home. And I wake up the next morning. I know I have to go see my PO tomorrow, which is like 1 day away. And if I don't pee right, I'm going to jail, and I really don't want to go there, but I don't feel very well again. And for some strange reason, I feel like it's a good idea that if I drink some bleach, I could beat his test the next day, and I'll be fine. So that's what my brain tells me, intelligent things like that. And so I go about my business, I come back home, and I wake up the next morning, and I know I have about 6 hours to go see this guy. I know if I don't pee the way he wants me to, I'm going to jail. And for some reason, I just don't feel very well. And it doesn't seem to matter what consequences are coming down the pike at me. I can't seem to stop. So I do the only logical thing a real genius like me can do, a real tough guy, you know, is I take a bunch of other people's stuff to a pawn shop and I run to North Carolina. Because we've established that I'm not in any way interested in going back to jail, ever, ever again. But for some reason, I am physically unable to stop consuming this thing that is going to send me back there. And so, to show you how intelligent I am, within 10 days, I get arrested in Buffalo, New York. For those of you who never went to school, let me help you. They're really far away from each other. And now I get to sit in jail in Buffalo, New York, which is really cold if you've never been there. It's very unpleasant. And I get to go back home to Lehigh County Prison, you know, where they need me to stay there and hold the fort down, you know. And I get to see my friend Judgy Wudgy. I don't know if anybody here has ever met Judgy Wudgy. He's over there before. But this Judgy Wudgy said in particular to me, you know, Chris, you're 19 years old. Clearly this isn't working out for you very well. We just picked you up in Buffalo. That's like way up there. You weren't supposed to leave the state. When you're done with your time, we're gonna send you to rehab, fix this thing. And I said, cool. Yeah, whatever you want, Judgy Wudgy. After my time, good long time, he sent me to this place called the Keenan House in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Beautiful, beautiful row home. 80 people living in it, you know. And for the whole time I was there, I kept my shirt tucked in. Still don't, just because of that. And I listened to everything they said to me, and I went to every group I could, and I read the 12 steps at least a couple of times. You know, and I did everything they told me to do, and I accumulated some ideas of how I was going to keep myself sober when I got out of there, because I was really, really, really tired of living the life I had started to live. Right, and I accumulated these ideas that I'll share with you because I think they're really impressive. Because when I get out of the Keenan House, I'm going to get a job, I'm going to work a lot of hours and get back with my girlfriend. But at like 8 o'clock, I'm going to go to a meeting because they were talking about that stuff. And that's a really good plan. I don't think anybody could beat that plan. That's about the most solid plan I've heard of ever. Right, Jim? That's a good plan. Like 80% of people who leave rehab have that plan. That's a strong plan. And I had like a year clean too, so I was good. And so I got out. My dad graciously picked me up, took me wherever they were harboring me at that point with my new awesome plan. And he sat me down. And he said, Chris, what are you going to do? Like, you're an idiot. This is like the third time we've done this. What are you going to do? And I said, Pop, I'm going to get a job and work a lot of hours. Like, I am so ready just to be done with this. Like, I really just want to be a good son and a good brother and a good friend to the zero friends I had left and like a good... I just wanted to be a good person and go to work and like wait some tables and hang out with some people and like be okay and not disappoint my mom and dad at every turn and not kill my little brothers and make them go to school all sad and depressed that their idiot brother's in jail. I just wanted to be okay. And every fiber of my being just wanted to be okay at that point. But for some strange reason, as soon as I got the keys to my life back in my hand, I found myself back in a bathroom somewhere in Allentown, Pennsylvania. It didn't matter that I just spent a whole year separated from drugs and alcohol. It didn't seem to matter that every bit of me wanted nothing more than just to be okay and be sober. It didn't seem to matter anything Nothing seemed to matter. Not one thing. Because the second I got the keys to my life back in my hands, I failed. Again. This time it sucked because it didn't produce the effect that it used to. And now I'm just in this bathroom depressed and sad and real paranoid because I had two POs and they want me to pee in cups more than I pee in toilets. And it's just an awful, 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 awful feeling. Right? It's sad. And it started maybe a 60-day stretch of my life. Really not that long. I'm not even good enough to live a full life. 60 days. And it starts a 60-day stretch of just some ugly things, hanging out with some real, real ugly people. Jeff, you know? I'm just joking. You're a lovely guy, you know? And it started this stretch where I was hanging out with some real ugly people, doing some real ugly things, sleeping in some real ugly places. And I can distinctly recall sitting on a park bench at the old Emmaus Community Park with like a squirrel next to me. And just looking out on the horizon of my future and thinking about it, there was nothing there for me. Like on my best day, I might be able to stay out of jail for like 60 days. I might be able to not disappoint my mom for like 30 minutes at a time. You know, all my friends from school are like going to college and developing relationships with humans, and I'm on a park bench with a squirrel. And the squirrel doesn't even like me that much too, I'm sure. And it's not good, you know, and real early in the morning on August 27, 2007, I was taking a walk in a region of Allentown, Pennsylvania I had no business being in. 9th and Gordon Streets, if anyone's interested. Lovely, lovely location. And a little black Honda pulled up beside me, and a real paraphrased version of what occurred that day. I heard, you know, what are you doing? I said, I'm taking a walk. And the guy in that car said, put your hands up against the wall. And I'm fairly confident that on that very day, God sent the Allentown Vice Squad to put an end to what was going on with me. Because there was absolutely no way of my own free will and my own power I could have stopped the awful, awful train that I was on. But the Allentown Vice Squad did in fact have that power. And they did. They ended it. They sent me right back to Lehigh County Prison that morning. And I got to sit there for a little while until I saw my old buddy, Judgy Wudgy. You know, and when I saw Judgy Wudgy, he hit me with a good version of what you're about to hear. He said, Chris, you're 20 years old. Clearly this ain't working out too well. You know, we just found you over on 9th and Gordon Streets. You don't live anywhere near there. I'm not sure what you're doing. I'm going to send you to rehab again. I'll give you another chance. I said, whatever. Who cares? And they sent me to this place called Bowling Green. And I went down there, and I sat there in the middle of a whole 100 and some people, and I listened to the stuff, and I read the steps on the wall a few times. And I was fairly confident that there was no hope for me moving forward. I was fairly confident that at best I was going to get out maybe last 30 days and then go back to jail and then keep going on the vicious cycle. I had absolutely no hope for my future. There was nothing. Thankfully, I had a counselor who was way smarter than me, and he said, you know, hey, man, you've been here for about 20 days. The county's sick of paying for you to be here. How about a halfway house? And at that point, I told him absolutely not, because the only people who go to halfway houses are loser junkies, you know, who live under bridges and have beards and stuff. Rich, right? I'm not going. I'm not going to a halfway house. He says, how about you go upstairs tonight and pray about that? And I said, absolutely not going to happen. If God isn't real. If God was real, I'd be dead. I asked him to kill me a bunch of times. Clearly, that did not work. He says, all right, how about you go upstairs and say, give me some inspiration. Just throw it in the air and see what happens. And so I said, all right, I can do that. And I went back up to my little hotel room that I shared with two other men, both of them on sleep apnea machines, because that's my luck everywhere I go. And I listened to those machines whir, you know, their swan song into the evening. And, you know, probably around 3 o'clock in the morning, I just said, hey, give me some inspiration, whatever. And I woke up about 6 o'clock and I ate the mush they provided for me. And I walked back across the way to that counselor and I said, hey, man, you know, and he said, how about that halfway house? And at that point, I got the opportunity to say the most spiritual thing I've ever said, still to this day, which was okay. And within a few hours, they had me shipped on this halfway house in Lititz, Pennsylvania. For those of you who are not familiar with Lititz, Pennsylvania, it's basically like a cornfield. And I was real angry because the plan I had developed while I was in this treatment center was to get a job, work a lot of hours, get back with my girlfriend and go to a meeting. And in my mind, it made perfect sense that this was going to work. But for some strange reason, like, I'm an idiot. But now, contrary to my plan, I'm at this halfway house. And I've learned that everything good in my life happens contrary to my plans. And I get in there. It's true. It's really true, isn't it? And I get into this halfway house, and the first thing they tell me is you have to go to a meeting. And I go to this meeting that night, not of this fellowship, and I raise my hand. at the end of the meetings, that's what they tell me to do, and get phone numbers. So I raise my hand and say, Chris, I'm new, need phone numbers. And they shoot a stupid little yellow piece of paper all the way around the room, and they fill it with like 100 phone numbers. And I take it, and as I'm walking out the door, I crumble it up and I throw it away. Because at this point, if phone numbers were going to fix what was wrong with me, I would have obtained every phone number in the world twice. Not going to happen. I get back to the halfway house, and I get in a lot of trouble for not having phone numbers. So they send me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous the next night at the local clubhouse. And they say, get the phone numbers and bring them back to me. And so I raise my hand, and I get a bunch of phone numbers. I bring them back to my stupid counselor, and I throw the phone numbers at the stupid counselor. I say, stupid counselor, here's your stupid phone numbers. She says, use those phone numbers to get a ride to a meeting. So I go to the super awesome phone that is attached to the wall. Because I don't have a cell phone. They didn't have them for me, you know. And I dialed the first number. I said, I'm Chris. I'm new. I need a ride to a meeting tonight. And on the other end of the line, I heard the best thing I've ever heard still. He says, yeah, man, but gas is real expensive, and lit is real far away. Do you have any money? I said, no. I live in a halfway house. I just got out of jail and rehab. I have like 13 cents and some pocket lint, you know. And I'm discouraged, but I pick up the phone again another time because it's not too heavy for me yet. You know, I'm still beefy. And I call and I'm saying, hey, I'm Chris, I'm new, I need a ride to a meeting. And on the other end of the line, I hear, yeah, but gas is real expensive, and lit is real far away. You got any money? No. You know, and I hang up very discouraged. But I have some third times of charm crap probably running through my head. And I call the third number on the other end of the line. I hear, yeah, man, the gas is real expensive, and lit is real far away. You got any money? And I'm done. I'm done with AA. I'm done with halfway house. I'm done with everything. And I make a plan, because I'm always really good at plans. I make a plan to physically injure the next person who comes within arm's reach of me so I can go back to jail and start the cycle again, because this one isn't working. Real contrary to that plan, the next person that comes to me was a happy little fella. He tapped me on the shoulder. He said, Chris, this guy just called here, wants to pack as many guys into his car as he can and go to a meeting. Are you in? And I said, sure, it'll make it look like I got my own ride. Absolutely. And he said, be ready at 6:30. So 6:30 rolls around, and this guy pulls into this parking lot of this halfway house. He jumps out of this car with a fire I've never seen before in my life. He goes, yo, man, we're new turf on this number. It's such a great time. And he's screaming at me. And I'm so, so angry at this guy. Because he is so excited about this thing that I'm not even remotely interested in. Even worse than that, he stopped me in the back seat of his car. And I do terrible in back seats because I have a huge body and an even bigger ego. And he's taking me on this 45-minute odyssey to the Karen Foundation. A place that I also hate because I could never go anywhere that nice. And the entire 45-minute ride up, all I can think about is how if I was wealthy enough to own a belt, I could take it off, choke this happy guy out, and we can go off the side of the road and be done. And that's where I was legitimately at. I wanted to kill the happy guy just cause. Thankfully, I was not wealthy enough to own a belt. So we made it to the Karen Foundation safely. And at the Karen Foundation, there was a meeting real similar to this one, just a much more expensive place and a much more expensive podium. And behind that real expensive podium that night was a squirrely little guy from Philadelphia. And I hated him because he was talking about a bunch of stuff I couldn't relate to. And all I knew about AA is I had to relate to everybody all the time or I was going to die. And I couldn't relate. He was talking about all sorts of jive. He was talking about getting arrested by park rangers and getting driven to CFCF in dune buggies and kicking Russian guys' flowers over on Roosevelt Boulevard. And I don't even know what Roosevelt Boulevard is at this point in my life, and I hate him. Somewhere intertwined in all of that stuff I couldn't relate to, he was talking about how absolutely miserable he was, how he saw nothing on his horizon of his future, how he's awfully, awfully uncomfortable inside all the time, how he could never sleep at night, how his life just basically sucked all the time. And I thought he hit it so close to the way I felt that I thought he was making fun of me. And I made some plans to beat him up after the meeting. Because that's what I do. I'm a tough guy, you know. And towards the end, he stopped. And he said, now I got a sponsor. I worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had this spiritual awakening. Now my life's awesome. I can sleep real well at night. I'm okay and comfortable in situations. I can look people in the eye. I can smile. I go home. I have a girlfriend. I have a home. Blah, 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 blah. He was telling me all this great stuff. And it caught my attention. Just enough to go up to him after the meeting and say, squirrely little guy, how'd you do that? And he pointed across the room to an equally squirrely guy I'd never met before in my life. And he said, ask that guy to be your sponsor, to which I responded, absolutely not. You know, that's creepy. That's real creepy. It's like asking another guy to be your Valentine. It's just something you don't do. knowing that I was not interested in doing that, he walked out of his way from behind the podium to arrange for me a ride back to the halfway house with the guy he told me to ask. Now I'm stuck in this guy's crappy Kia for 45 minutes, banging my head on the roof, coffee stains on the roof, stupid Kia. Kias are little. I hate them. And he's talking all sorts of really cool spiritual stuff, I'm sure. But my mind was racing a billion miles a second. I was thinking, if I ask God to be a sponsor, is he going to punch me and kick me and kill me and throw me in the car? Is he going to shoot me? What's going to happen? And I'm freaking out. My mind is going nuts. Where did that water come from? Did I just pee a water out? That was awkward. And finally, at the end of that ride, it's a good water, right? At the end of that ride, I braced for the punch, and I just said, yo, dude, will you be my sponsor? And he just looked at me, and he said, yeah, man. Yeah, you got a big book, man? At that point, I thought he was going to ask me for $13 or something. And he reached into his back seat, and he handed me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, read a doctor's opinion, call me in the morning. And so I went back to my halfway house, top bunk. That's right, I lived on the top bunk. And I read the doctor's opinion, the first chapter in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I read it about 133 times because I knew there was going to be a test the next day. And I had to understand it, you know, because I'm a smart guy. And I understood zero words because it was written in 1930s speak. And I don't speak 1930s. I spoke 2007 at that point, you know. And I called him anyway the next morning. I said, Drew, I read that. What do you want to do? And he said, man, 6:30, be ready. Okay. 6:30, roll around, crappy Kia pulls right up into the parking lot, tosses me right in the passenger seat, drives me back down to his apartment in the city of Lancaster without asking me for a penny of gas money, invites me into his home without fear for his electronics, first time that's happened in a long time for a guy like me. And he sat me down on the couch and he explained to me what I'd read the night before and what I'd understood through that guy that day blew my mind. Because it explained to me why every single time I had the keys to my life in my hands, I failed. In a book written 50 years before I was born explained why every single time I had the keys to my life in my hands, I fail. And it blew my mind. And then he was asking me a bunch of other questions and then asking me more questions. And then I was on my knees in a gravel parking lot praying to a God I didn't believe in. And then he threw a notebook at me and I was writing stuff in a notebook I really didn't feel like writing in a notebook. And shortly after that, I was telling him the stuff I wrote in that notebook and I really didn't feel like telling him the stuff I wrote in that notebook. And shortly after that, I was praying to this God that I really didn't believe in again. And then I writing in a notebook again. And then he was sending me back to Allentown to like pay people back. And then he was showing me this fancy way I could keep up with my spiritual condition and like not fall back into the guy I used to be. And then he was showing me how to pray and like meditate a little bit. And then he was sending me back to a halfway house that I'd since moved out of to like show other guys what had happened in my life. And I don't even think I knew what was happening in my life. And I'm pretty confident that that guy tricked me into working the 12 steps. But some things that I noticed as a result of having been tricked into working those 12 steps were pretty amazing. Because I would go back home and I would fall right asleep. I lived in like a rat dump apartment with like gaping holes in the wall. Like not the interior wall, the exterior wall. And like there were animals and just all sorts. It was like a game preserve. It was really cool. There were no locks on any of the doors. But I was super excited to go back to that thing every day. Because this weird thing had happened in my life. There was no explanation for what had happened. The only thing that I could put my finger on that was different between that time and every other time I'd tried to get sober was the 12 steps. The only thing that I could locate. And I noticed some really weird stuff happening. Like I would sleep really well at night. I wouldn't sit up and I wouldn't lament everything in the world. And I wouldn't have any problems that were so great that it would prevent me from sleeping, even though last night I couldn't sleep because I was so hyped up about the Eagles. Just saying. It was a good game, I have to say. And I would notice that I could go into a room and genuinely look in somebody's eyes and care a little bit about how they were doing and a little bit less about how I was doing. And I found myself going to my job, waiting tables and not throwing up in trash cans and not disappearing for 4 hours at a time. And I found myself coming back up this way to Allentown, Pennsylvania every single Monday, my only day off, and paying people back, including the county, of which I owed many thousands of dollars. And I started to gather that like months and months and months had gone by, and I hadn't even considered consuming a substance. I haven't even considered drinking anything. And it was absolutely awesome. Strange. Really strange. And so, I'll tell you a little bit about what my life is like today, Jim. So excited you're here. I was actually going to text you the other day and I just forgot. But that's why God's funny. He puts people back in your life that you forget. And Jeff, I wasn't going to text you, but I should have. Today my life's absolutely ridiculous and insane, because like 8.5 years ago or whatever, I was sitting on a park bench with a squirrel, and I had absolutely no hope of doing anything but maybe going to jail, going to rehab, disappointing my family, disappointing everybody that I came in contact with, including Joji Wudgie, and like just nothing good. And 8.5 years later, as a result of working the 12 steps and staying close to God and close to the people in the program, if you will, that have come before me, I have been able to do a whole bunch of ridiculous stuff, like wander all over the place and speak at meetings and meet a whole bunch of real interesting friends that I still have to this day. You know, I've gotten to like be the best man at my little brother's wedding, the little brother who wrote me a letter when I was at the halfway house that stated very simply, "I hate your guts. I don't ever want to talk to you again, but here are some Grateful Dead CDs because no man should be without them." I was the best man at his wedding over the summer. Little Hawk came with me. It was a beautiful, beautiful day. And things like that don't happen to guys like me. Things like that don't happen to guys who sit on park benches with squirrels and eat out of dumpsters and do all sorts of stupid stuff. You know, I was able to spend like the last 8 birthdays with my mom and my dad. You know, I was able to do that just a couple weeks ago. We went and ate at Shady Maple, and they drive all the way down that way just to spend some time with me. I haven't had to disappoint them. I haven't had to send my mom to work worrying about where her son is for like 8.5 years. I haven't had to send my dad anywhere with the guilt and the shame of knowing that his firstborn son is a complete loser sitting in jail in like 8.5 years. Those are things I can't do on my own. Because when I have the keys to my life in my hands, I fail. But when I give the keys to something greater than me and I let that thing drive, I can succeed. Because as of right now, I have ridiculous multiple businesses with great friends that are willing to come to Quakertown, Pennsylvania on a Monday night. You know, I have all this stuff that would just be physically impossible if I had done it on my own. Physically impossible. Because I proved it to myself over and over and over that I lack the ability to do anything except for fail. And as soon as I give my life to something greater, I'm 100% taken care of at any given moment. When I go home tonight, since the Eagles were not on tonight, I will go directly to sleep, probably in a chair, not even in a bed. Sometimes I don't even make it up there. When I'm in a room with a ridiculous number of people that I don't know, I am not uncomfortable anymore. It's very strange. I can look people in the eye. I can actually look around this room and point out people that I can say are my friends. And that alone is a testament to the power behind the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I will close with this so that you can all go smoke. It's true. I know it's on your mind. I know it. If you're in this room with me tonight and you can relate to the ways that I used to feel, I mean, that's probably a good and bad thing at the same time. But if you're sick of feeling that way, you're sick of being a constant disappointment, you're sick of letting your family and your friends down, you're sick of not being able to sleep, you're sick of everything in the world weighing you down, you're sick of being a failure, a loser, a bum, a hawk. There's a really, really cool, really, really free, really, really awesome way out of that. And that is called the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way to do that is to find a man or a woman who has a working knowledge of those 12 steps, ask them how they got out of the hole that they were in, and follow them blindly like a puppy dog until you experience the spiritual awakening and your life is transformed.
Thanks for having me, Tamara. I appreciate it.